Well, good evening. I feel like I'm on top of the Empire State Building. I'm sorry to have to do this. Feels very strange. But that's the way it is. We didn't read this last week. And as a result, I'm not quite sure where we are. Does anybody remember? It's probably 23 or 24, is my guess.
If you read the first line of 23.
I think it's 23.
One day after private instruction, he said, many monks of recent times say that one should go along with worldly customs. I don't think we read that. It's a very short one. Well, maybe we did, actually. Well, we can read it again. We didn't last week, no. Yes, we have done 22. Let's read 23.
One day after private instruction, he said, many monks of recent times say that one should go along with worldly customs. Now as I consider this matter, it is not so. Even in the mundane world, the wise say that it is impure to follow the vulgar ways of the populace. Take the likes of Chu Yuan, declaring that all the world is drunk, I alone am sober. He did not go along with the ways of the people, and in the end drowned in the Song River. How much the more so in Buddhist practices is everything contrary to worldly actions. Lay people adorn their hair, monks shave their hair off. Lay people eat a lot, monks eat once a day. Everything is contrary. Afterwards, though, they become people of great peace and bliss. Therefore, do monks turn away from the habits of the world.
Well, this is another prime example of how Dogen is talking to monks and not exactly to us, because we're not monks. But we live a sort of halfway life that Suzuki Roshi marveled at in his lifetime, that we could do monk practice on occasion, and practice in daily life as lay people as well. Koban always told us, practice as if you're undercover agents. You don't have to say what you are, who you are, just practice like everybody else. But bring your practice into the world. He said it's not time to have monk's practice anymore. He said the world is so hot that only by living in the world will practice cool it off. That was his view. And of course, there are other views that say that, as my friend Mary Orr always says, that monks who are living by themselves and practicing in caves for their whole lives are the ones who are cooling off the world. That's what's saving the world. These are all words to encourage people to continue to do what they're doing. And monk's life is really tough. One meal a day. It's cold. And yet, it's true that in Zazen practice itself is peace and bliss. And the whole life of a monk is devoted to Zazen and sustaining the situation around it so it can happen. And you can say that's our life too. Here in the Quaker meeting house, and just the work that it takes to keep floating Zendo going and to keep our lives going and to practice. You can't say it's a monk's life, but you can't say it's a lay life either. And it's not that we shouldn't go to the movies or go on vacation or have a wonderful time here and there. All of that is infused with our practice until we can't really tell what the difference is. When I first began to practice, I had three little kids, so I couldn't go to Sesshin except by working around their schedule. And so I would go to Sesshin and then come home and then go back and then come home. And at first it felt very strange, and I thought it wasn't working. It felt so weird. But once I got it, I realized I was bringing the practice home with me. And my feeling about home changed. And when I went back, I realized that home always went with me wherever I went. And that it was appropriate to be a part of Sesshin. It was a big help, actually. So this kind of distinction is helpful sometimes. People go off to Tassajara for 3 months. It's a great opportunity. You just leave everything behind, everything, and just practice. That's a real vacation. But there's lots in between. Anything? Samia?
Today I finally got to painting my windows. Lots of windows. And I thought if I cleaned the windows really good, because the way I clean is anything is better than nothing. Not like it should be perfect. Yes. It's a little cleaner. Just clean it from the outside. They don't have to be clean from the inside. But I said if I did a good job with cleaning, it's probably kind of like a good ground meditation to practicing the piano. I'd be, you know, I would be there, you know, a lot of the time rather than, you know, not. And the windows were really clean. And then I was like totally getting into it, and I'm thinking, okay, now which is really the practice?
Good question.
Yeah, it was interesting, and I couldn't sit this morning, kind of by choice, so it got all kind of kneaded together.
Mm-hmm.
It was really nice.
Mm-hmm.
Even with the streets and the,
yeah,
just to watch it,
yeah,
and be with it.
In the monastery, they have people cleaning all the time. They have to clean everything they cleaned the day before, wash the windows they cleaned the day before, and it's just the doing of it, the action itself, that without any meaning in it. Yeah, that's what you were doing too.
And then you wonder when you're practicing, like let's say the piano, where
where there's theory in it and trying really to get all of it, at which point do you say, forget the meaning of it, kind of like chanting?
Yeah.
And it's kind of hard to let go of that.
You can't know when the time is ripe. It just happens, doesn't it? When it begins to take you over rather than you imposing it on. But you have to know an awful lot before it succeeds in taking you over. Any art is that way, I think. But that's the point of the art, of course, is to practice until it's doing it rather than you.
But is that different than sitting?
I think sitting is the ultimate art.
You know, there's you need to know, like, I feel I don't know anything or very little about the Dharma, and
you don't need to know much. But you do need to know. You do need a teacher. You do need to hear the Dharma in some way. That's why we always end up in a place like this. But only as we, you know, ultimately the idea is that the Dharma just falls away too. Buddha falls away, the Dharma, everything. It's all just a way of helping us to tune up, you could say, to find our seat, find our life, in our life, in our way.
I came across a Thich Nhat Hanh thermal can, and it has like chants for like everything, like cleaning the windows,
yes,
and
going to the toilet,
yes,
taking a shower,
yes.
Yeah.
I thought that was great.
Yes, Akin Roshi had people writing their own gathas for washing the car and taking your child to nursery school. He said you could write a gatha for anything. That you're offering whatever you're doing to Buddha.
There was a cute one about while watering a potted plant.
Oh, nice.
Like, yeah, I was like, don't be scared, little plant, that you're not out in the wild. Something like that. Just water. Yeah, it was.
Oh, that can get very precious. Wow. Anything to call attention to what we're doing. That's really the point. Anything else?
So, why would you call attention to what you're doing instead of just doing it?
Well, just doing things is dangerous sometimes. And it's sleepwalking other times. So that, excuse me, it isn't a matter of being self-conscious. I think that's why I said precious, because I think that's a little over self-conscious. But it reminds one that there is something going on. And if we think we're the agent, then we get confused. So if we're noticing that the things are happening and they're going on and offering it, then it isn't us anymore. It's just part of the whole thing happening. So it's a way of dropping the self.
the application from, it's more far-reaching than what we're doing, like watering a plant for IV. So it's working with the clients and affirming or acknowledging emotions, their states of their life. It's coming up, this sense is very much the same. Know by sitting and watching with all our thoughts combined. It seems that a lot of people that I know in this area just want to get through everything fast.
That's true. Speed has a lot to do with it. Those things slow us down. Thich Nhat Hanh's bell slows us down to anything that makes us, because our mind is the speed. It isn't our body that's speeded up. It's just our mind is flinging itself through space, it seems like.
The aversion to things, not wanting to pay attention,
yes,
being conscious, feeling sad, breathing.
Or just skipping from subject to subject to subject. No, I think we're made that way. We have this funny little animal that just jumps and jumps and jumps. And it's a good excuse if there's something in there we don't want to face. And a lot of people say, oh, I couldn't sit. I couldn't sit. I couldn't sit still. You know, my mind is going all the time. Of course, it is going all the time. But something else is going on at the same time. Or not going on.
I mean, isn't it also about the contact, I mean, the content of our life as well? I mean, I think part of the tragedy of having mind going on is you lose so much of, I mean, I had this idea in my head of what life is like, you know, compared to like a movie or, you know, like,
yes,
limited, but so much of our life is spent having, and it has nothing to do with that, watering the plant or watching,
yes,
the earth.
Yes.
And keeping those things in mind helps keep other things in perspective, at least in my experience.
It actually creates your world. Now, the more you're able to be in the world that you're in, the more control you have over it, the more you can actually create it rather than just be pushed around by it and driven by it. Now, if we slow down and can be with it, then we can see what needs to be done and do it with some kind of even affection. You know, we can like to water the plant instead of grumbling and saying, oh, damn, I have to do it again. You know, it's our whole life is like that. We can either accept it and make something beautiful of it, or just bumble and grumble through it in a way. I mean, we bumble through it anyway, but we actually have the power to create our life and make it fine. Chogyam Trungpa always taught his students to try to make a lot of money and live in big houses and wear really nice clothes and just, you know, fit in a good way in society and show how life can be if you live in an honest way in terms of the Dharma. It's interesting because we think of in Zen and the monks and the one meal a day and all of that. He wasn't like that at all. They had banquets.
He was also known, you know, for taking such care of dressing and handling his clothes.
Like, yes.
I understood he handled like a suit and putting on his tie, just like he was putting on his monk's robes. I mean, that's what he brought to it from what I understand.
Well, he did long, long retreats before those days also. But he did look terrific. Just fabulous. Big gold watch, probably a Rolex, I would bet, you know. And a suit in the park. Amazing. Well, let's read the next one.
One day he said, in the method of governing the world, from the emperor above to the multitudes of people below, all of those who occupy specific offices cultivate the appropriate work. When those who are not suitable for occupying office, that is called rebelling against heaven.
When the course of government is in harmony with the inner will of heaven, and the world is tranquil and the people are at ease, therefore the emperor rises in the third quarter of the third watch about 2:30 a.m., making that the time for the government of the land is not an easy thing.
As for the methods of Buddha, it is just a matter of change of station and difference of work. The king of a nation by himself uses his intellect to plan the course of government, considering former guidelines, seeking ministers endowed with knowledge of the way. When the affairs of government and the will of heaven are in mutual harmony, this is called governing the world. If this is neglected, heaven is rejected, the world is in confusion, and the people suffer.
From there on down, all the various dukes, nobles, officers, knights, and common people each have the work which they do. To follow this is called humanity. To go against this confuses the affairs of heaven, and therefore is subject to the punishment of heaven.
Therefore, you people who study the way of the Buddhas should never for a single moment wish to rest your bodies idly on the pretext of detachment from society and of having left the householding life. Although at first it seems to have benefit, later on it would be greatly detrimental. Following the manners of leavers at home, you should completely master this station and carry out its tasks.
In the government of the mundane world, though they consider precedent and seek the worthy, there are no examples handed down by former sages and past masters. Then it even happens that they will follow the example of the times on their own. But for Buddhists, there are definite precedents and written teachings right before us. Also, teachers who bear the accepted tradition presently exist.
I have a thought. In all phases of comportment, if in every respect you consider former guidelines and follow past masters in cultivating your practice, how could you fail to attain the way? Lay people want to be in accord with the will of heaven. Patriarched ones want to be in accord with the will of Buddha. They carry out their tasks equally, but the latter result obtained is superior. Once attained, it is attained forever. For the sake of such great tranquility and joy, to suffer one generation of illusory transformation, this body, to follow the will of Buddhas, should alone be in the heart of the wayfarer.
Nevertheless, there is nothing in the Buddhist teachings which encourages anyone to rashly torment the body or do things which are not to be done. If you go in accord with the practice of restraint and the refinements of behavior, your body will naturally be at ease, your behavior consistent and unobtrusive to others.
Therefore, abandoning the selfish ideas of bodily comfort which you are now entertaining, you should acquiesce completely to the Buddha's regulations.
I wonder what was going on. There were It's easy to get into that beatnik Zen of thinking you can just relax and kick back and let it all happen as it will. This is all based on his training in China, in which Confucian teachings were very strong. And this whole business about the will of heaven and the hierarchy that everybody, dukes, nobles, officers, knights, and common people each have the work which they do. You're given your place and your work and you do it to serve the whole, you could say. Your family is part of the whole family of society. So even as a monk, you have a place and a job and a way that you're serving. Interesting, I've heard a couple of talks lately about how in our society we started out with the idea that we were working in order to have a job and have an income, but working in something that was also serving the general population. If we worked in a grocery store, it was to offer people the opportunity to buy food. We worked in a factory making, I don't know, bottling popcorn, then that was to offer people, so that there was an interchange between self-serving and society serving. And several people have commented this week that in these last 10 years or so, there's much, much less of society serving, and that in business schools that often people are taught that you're creating business in order to make money for yourself and your stockholders. And it doesn't matter what you're making or what you're doing, that it's the money only. And it's a completely different attitude. I don't know how general that is, but it struck me that I heard that in two different, completely different places. But in Confucius, certainly in his teaching, everything was working together. The whole society worked together like bees. And we have this sort of it's a Buddhist koan as well as one in this country of how do we serve and develop and cultivate ourselves and support ourselves and the general world that we are as well. If we go too far on the self side, then it becomes very selfish. And if we go too far on the other side, then that's kind of crazy. So there's some middle place where we really can't say anymore that sometimes we're putting our hand out to help someone and sometimes we're withdrawing. Sometimes we're engaged in a way that's contributing in an obvious way, and other times it's very quiet. And maybe has more about our own mental health than it has about the the general, presumably, but our own mental health has a great deal to do with the general public. So we're always making our way in this way. How do we do this? What is our place and how can we serve? And when we ordain, we vow to just give our whole life to service, which doesn't mean we don't have a life ourselves, but that what comes first is the vow. And I love that he makes it about the body, not the mind. It's just about the body. To follow the will of Buddhas, this body should alone be in the heart of the wayfarer. It's so easy to get caught up in the ideas of it. But this isn't really ideas. This is an experience, a practice. And it's with this. So we abandon selfish ideas of bodily comfort, which you are now entertaining, he says. So I think, what are they doing? Fun to try to peek inside and see what they were, what those monks were.
I think it's interesting that the sentence, if you are in accord with the practice of restraint and refinements of behavior, your body will naturally be at ease. Your behavior consisting in an appreciative state. That this would satisfy the body. I think that's an. I think people usually assume not. Like,
yes.
If they let the body go, it would be just this like massive hit or something.
A blob on the sofa with a beer in its hand. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's actually happier with restraint. You know, I mean.
And we all know that's true. Yeah. It's true for the mind and the body. And the more self-discipline that we're able to practice, the more balanced and easy we feel.
Those commercials don't think that.
No, we're not taught that at all. Totally contradictory. So the trick about mastering our station and carrying out our tasks is that they keep changing. And in the monastery they do that too. You are given a task, and in the beginning it's something that you don't know how to do, like the bells, and you shiver and shake and try and fail and make a mess, and it's all very fraught. And little by little, it begins to feel more comfortable. And just when you're beginning to feel like you know what you're doing, bam, they give you a whole nother job. Something in the kitchen or out in the garden somewhere. So that you're always getting a chance to not get too comfortable, not get too self-satisfied. I always think we should encourage ourselves to do something like that in our life, our ordinary, everyday life. Sort of like Samyo with her piano. Every time you sit down, it's a challenge like that. And I think any art is that way. That we can push ourselves a little bit. Try something we haven't tried before. Do something that we don't think we can do. and try it anyway. It keeps us awake and opens up worlds that otherwise we get kind of stodgy. I think that's why in Zen they have in Japan developed so many different arts. Now, and the arts that they developed are the kind that you never get to the end of. You never get so good at it that you can say, well, I'm the best and I don't, you know, I'm perfect and everything is fine. It's never fine. You always, every time you learn some new thing about it, calligraphy, flower arranging, music. Keeps us awake and keeps us awake to what runs through us that actually creates, is the creative force. I could go on and on about that, but it's 8 o'clock. But I encourage you to, if not an art with a capital A, something that challenges you. They can give you great joy. Tea ceremony is one of them. So...